From Genetic Engineering and Biotechnology News, this is the GenCast Network. Bringing you compelling and in-depth interviews with the biotech industry's leading researchers, newsmakers, and thought leaders. This week on the GenCast Network. Dr. Nitan Beliga from the Institute of Systems Biology is interviewed by Gen's Editor-in-Chief John Sterling about a new model that predicts the molecular response of living cells to genetic or environmental changes.
Dr. Nitan Beliga works on developing systems-level approaches to better understand how organisms mount responses to complex changes in their environment. He has a Master of Science degree in Marine Biotechnology from Goa University in India, and he won a PhD in Microbiology from the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. Dr. Beliga, your team and scientists from New York University reported the development of a model that rapidly characterizes and accurately predicts the molecular level response of a free-living cell to genetic and environmental changes. This model is called EGRIN, which stands for Environmental and Gene Regulatory Influence. How does this model work?
What's important to learn here is that when organisms sense a new environment, they tend to modulate expression of hundreds to thousands of genes. And as you know, the genes encode proteins that interact with one another physically or functionally, say in metabolic networks, to assemble into these biological networks. So the modulation of the genes results in dynamic modulation of these networks that eventually enables the organism to acclimate to this new environment. And the EGRIN model that we have constructed is a model for this process. It describes how this process occurs, and it also is capable of describing and predicting how the cell would respond to a new environment. And in practical terms, what we do is we measure some key parameters within the cells, and these parameters are measured once the cells are exposed to the new environment. And then by feeding the parameters into the EGRIN model, we can predict how most of the genes in this organism will dynamically be modulated over time, and eventually the cells acclimate to the new environment.
Can you talk about the actual results of your study? What were you able to clearly demonstrate when all the results were in?
In about 250-odd experiments, what we did was to systematically investigate the behavior of the cells to a diverse array of environmental and genetic changes. So we constructed a model for control of cellular responses to the environment using data from all of these experiments. We then conducted a whole set of new experiments where the cells were subjected to new environmental perturbations and new genetic perturbations. These were administered either singularly or in combination. And what we were able to clearly demonstrate was that with just a few measurements of key parameters within the cell, this model was able to accurately predict how about 80% of all of its genes would respond to new environmental and genetic changes. Now, this is exciting because this model was constructed from a modest number of experiments. And despite this, it is capable of predicting behavior in new environments. And this is also exciting because it tells us that there are certain properties within biological and environmental networks which will enable similar kinds of studies in all organisms, especially those for which genome sequences will become available.
The research group relied on Halobacterium salinarum, NRC1, which is a member of the Archaea family of organisms, for this study. Why did you choose this organism? What did you learn from working with it?
As you know, there's thousands of new genome sequencing efforts that are underway right now, and hundreds have already been completed. What's unfortunate is for most of these organisms, we have little understanding of how their biology works, despite having a complete sequence for the genome. Now, what our goal was to delineate a data-driven approach that could be used to rapidly characterize such organisms. And this was one of the main motivations for choosing Halobacterium. The reason being it itself was poorly characterized. Now, an equally important angle to this is that the Halobacterium belongs to the Archaea family of organisms, which you just noted. And these are very different from the relatively better understood bacterial and eukaryotic organisms, such as E. coli and humans. Many of these organisms have this really interesting capability of growing in extremely harsh environments. Good examples would be deep sea hydrothermal vents, where you have temperatures above boiling and enormous pressures. They can also grow in a complete lack of oxygen. Halobacterium, for instance, can grow in saturated salt solutions. So in other words, what you can think of is of biology as something that has scanned every corner of our planet through billions of years of evolution. And this has resulted in fascinating solutions to really complex and unique problems, as many of the archaea and even bacteria and eukaryotes have done. So by characterizing these archaeal organisms, we stand to tap into these novel biological solutions, and if we understand how they work, we can apply them to problems in agriculture, bioenergy, and medicine. Now, in particular, Halobacterium could tell us, say, for example, how to improve agricultural practices in arid climates. And in such climates, salinity often tends to be a big problem. And in general terms, I would reiterate that the choice of Halobacterium forced us to come up with an approach that is relevant to all of the poorly characterized organisms. And you know, these are organisms with equally fascinating biological properties. So overall, the choice of Halobacterium was motivated by several different reasons.
Can you provide some of the specific details of what the process of discovery in the study involved in carrying out the actual experiment?
To uncover this model, what we did was first we took the cells and we systematically administered environmental stresses, say mildly toxic level of metals or sublethal doses of ultraviolet radiations and so forth. And in a different set of experiments, we also introduced into these cells targeted genetic mutations. For example, we took out some genes or we overexpressed some genes. And for all of these about 250-odd experiments, we monitored cellular behavior by measuring a large number of parameters for the entire cell. Good examples would be cell survival, growth, expression level changes in all genes, etc. Then we used sophisticated algorithms to integrate all of this diverse kinds of information and process them to construct a biological network model, which is the EGRIN model, which describes how all the genetic and environmental perturbations resulted in changes in expression of nearly 80% of genes in this organism. And what we realized at this point was that the network itself was so complex that to make sense of it and to explore it would require a whole array of new software and database solutions that would be developed by us or by other parties. And there was no framework at the time to do this that we could purchase off the shelf. So that forced us again to develop our own software framework and technology to accomplish this goal. And the tools that we developed were called Gaggle and FireGoose. These tools allowed us to explore the model and identify and verify some key biological hypotheses. And in particular, we focused on certain hypotheses that were key for verifying mechanistic aspects of this model. And it helped us evaluate how closely this model was truly representative of the true network in the cell.
This research required a systems biology approach in which scientists of varied disciplines, biochemistry, physics, mathematics, computation, statistics, genetics, I'm sure there are others, collaborated and contributed their skill sets to the achievement of a single scientific objective. How do you go about bringing such a group with disparate talents together? And just as important, how do you manage this type of research team and keep them focused on that single scientific objective?
This is true. This is a complex type of approach to apply. And the basic tenet of systems biology is that new and complex questions in biology drive the development of new leading-edge technologies. And these technologies, in turn, generate a large number of new kinds of data. Now, to analyze this data requires the development of new computational approaches, both to just analyze the data and also to visualize the processed information. And this results in turn in new biological insight. And clearly you see there's an iterative cycle here where biology drives technology, drives computation, which in turn drives the next cycle. The key here is to have people with different kinds of expertise working in close quarters. And to put such a team together requires a philosophy and an environment that encourages interdisciplinary collaboration. The Institute for Systems Biology, or ISB, was established to do just that. And you can see this right from the architecture of the building of this institute to the organization of faculty and staff. The entire culture at ISB thrives on collaboration. I can give you an example of this. My colleague, Dr. Richard Bonneau, who is the lead author on the paper, worked at ISB before he moved on to NYU and continued the collaboration. And when he was at ISB, he was instrumental in pioneering some of the computational algorithms in this effort. And we used to share an office where we often butted heads on almost a daily basis to tackle some of the more complex problems in biology. And at first, we spoke very different kinds of languages, his expertise being in computation and my expertise being in microbiology. But over time, we learned to communicate with one another. So the key to collaboration is coming up with a language that allows people of different expertise to understand one another. And ISB has been very successful at establishing such a culture. So I would say the organization of the institute and the philosophy are perhaps the two main things that allows an interdisciplinary approach such as the one we used here.
What's next on the research horizon in terms of applying the EGRIN model?
We think this is a significant step in the direction of reengineering biological systems. But the caveat is that there's a lot more work that needs to be done before we actually get to that stage. For instance, the model that we've constructed does not yet account for a plethora of regulatory mechanisms in the cell that are just as important in orchestrating cellular responses. For instance, regulation by small RNAs is a good example. It's a mechanism that we haven't considered yet, but we think that the approach that we've come up with is easily extensible to model control mechanisms mediated by all these other types of molecules. What is key is the appropriate technologies to measure these types of control mechanisms need to be developed, and they're just up and coming now. So our next goal would be to incorporate some of these new kinds of information into the EGRIN model and then to make it mechanistically accurate as much as possible to what is really operating in the cell. The other thing that we're particularly interested is to use this model to drive strategies for reengineering, which people call synthetic biology. And although I feel a significant amount of work needs to be done, I believe that we may get there a lot sooner than one would expect. And if we are successful in doing that, that opens up a whole new array of applications of this approach to a whole host of organisms to solve problems in bioenergy, bioremediation, and medicine. So our focus would be in improving the model and also in driving technologies to use this model for reengineering purposes.
For anyone interested in learning more about this research we've just been talking about, can you tell them where this was published and when?
This just appeared in the 28th December issue of the journal Cell, and they can access it from cell.com. And this is also a journal in print.
I'm John Sterling. Thanks for listening. Now we'd like your opinion on this week's podcast. Please go to www.gennews.com/blog and give us your thoughts. We would also appreciate it if you'd answer the following question. Based on the interview with Dr. Baliga, can you think of some practical applications for the environmental and gene regulatory influence model he discussed? Bye for now.
To learn more about topics discussed in this GenCast, or to listen to previous GenCasts, visit our website at www.genengnews.com. New GenCasts are posted every week, Thursday, 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. For the Gen Publishing editorial staff, I'm Jonathan Ellinghaus, saying thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in again next week to the GenCast Network.